200 years ago, how Maine became a state. In case you haven't heard, Maine has a birthday this year, a big one. On March 15th, the state turns 200. I'm Jennifer Rooks. In school, you likely learned part of Maine's statehood story, that before 1820, Maine was part of Massachusetts, and that Maine became a state as part of the Missouri Compromise, in which Maine entered the Union as a free state and Missouri as a slave state. But there is a whole lot more to the story. Today on Maine Calling, why were Maine citizens so eager to separate from Massachusetts? Did everyone want to separate, or did some people want to stay? What did statehood mean for the Wabanaki, women, people in northern Maine? We have three historians here to answer these questions and more next. But first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. As you probably heard, Maine is celebrating its bicentennial this year. Today, we'll hear the story of how Maine became a state and get a sense of what Maine was like back then. This show is part of Maine Calling's series of shows relating to Maine's bicentennial. Joining me in our studio, Liam Reardon. He is a professor of history at the University of Maine, and he specializes in early American history with a focus on the Revolutionary era. And Earl Shuttleworth, longtime Maine state historian. As always, we want to hear from you in the audience. What are your questions about what Maine was like 200 years ago, or the leading figures of that time? Email talk at mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. If you send an email to talk at mainepublic.org, please make it brief. And again, the phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Earl, take us back to the late 1700s in Maine. When this movement for statehood was fomenting, what was Maine like? How many people lived here? Where did they live? How did they consider themselves in relationship with Massachusetts?
Yes. Well, in terms of population, in 1790, which was the first U.S. census, there were 97,000 people in Maine. And by 1820, when we were petitioning for statehood, there were 298,000. So that was a considerable increase. And I think that was one of the issues, along with several others, that really positioned Maine to go for statehood, because we were a growing, developing area of the country. And this was in part because of our great natural resources. There was a lot of lumbering going on. We had a great coast with a lot of shipbuilding, seagoing, maritime activity. We also, particularly in what was then the central part of the state, we were finding a great increase in farming, particularly between the area between the Kennebec River and the Penobscot River. Rivers were the great highways. They were the way that the city, that the state developed in the 18th and 19th centuries.
And I'm going to actually go back a little bit further. Why is it that Maine was part of Massachusetts anyway? Wasn't New Hampshire in the way?
Well, that's,
Liam?
That's true. It is a puzzling thing to us that think of Massachusetts not being contiguous, but that has to do with our own sort of sense of how these boundaries work. You know, the United States is Alaska and Hawaii are in the United States, and that doesn't challenge us. But it was an issue in this period, and it did was part of the logic for why some people argued for Maine's independence.
Okay.
Well, and I think it also goes back, too, to the fact that when Maine was first explored and settled in the 17th century, there was a period when the whole issue of who owned Maine was somewhat unresolved. And then in the mid-17th century, there was some major machinations, and Massachusetts actually took the responsibility for the governing of Maine and for, in a sense, the actual ownership of Maine. So we became the province of Maine, or the district of Maine.
Okay. So, Liam, I know that there were certain people who were really early agitating for Maine statehood in the late 1700s, Who were these people? Why were they agitating for independence from Maine, from Massachusetts?
So the statehood era stretches from the 1780s to, of course, 1820. And one of the interesting things about this five-decade period is that the reasons that people desired to separate from Massachusetts changed over time.
Hmm.
So at the start of the movement in the 1780s and 90s, it was really led by conservative, wealthy Federalists in the Falmouth area. And I think they really thought that if they could separate themselves from people who were even wealthier in Boston, they could be kingpins in this new state. But after the 1780s and 90s, its sort of partisan alignment changes, and it becomes an issue that's really championed by Republicans in the three decades of the 19th century.
So what were some of the big issues, Earl?
Well, I think just to add to that, politically, you have the very interesting situation of William King, who is born in Scarborough before the Revolution, becomes a very well-to-do merchant and shipbuilder in Bath. And in the late 18th, early 19th century, he becomes the kind of primary figure for the advocacy of statehood. And at first, as Liam said, he starts as a Federalist. But then in the early 1800s, he switches parties and he becomes a Republican, which would really be like a Jeffersonian Democrat. And he realizes that the way in which to affect this statehood movement is to get a broader base of people. And although the population figures and the economic figures that I cited a few moments ago, Maine is changing very rapidly. It's developing, it's growing, and there's the emergence of a middle class here, and they need to appeal to that in order to make that break from Massachusetts, to get that political will to do that.
And isn't there some issue of protection, that there was a feeling that Maine was in many ways a frontier state and Massachusetts wasn't protecting the people who are settling going up the rivers and settling in Maine?
So this really comes to the fore in the War of 1812. If we think back about the politics of this era, they were even more hostile and vitriolic than party politics in the U.S. today, I would argue. So during the War of 1812, which was led by a Republican presidential administration, most of the Federalist political leadership of New England didn't want to participate in the war. So parts of the District of Maine are controlled and occupied by the British, and Massachusetts made no significant military effort to repulse them. So this did make statehood an even more powerful argument after the War of 1812, in the sense that Massachusetts wasn't willing to invest its resources in protecting the Eastern District.
Were there any issues that had to do with things like taxes and tariffs?
Well, the kind of classic issue that limits the effectiveness of the separation argument was the federal coasting law. And this allowed ships to not have to enter customs in any state that they were bordering. So as we mentioned before, Massachusetts has these kind of unusual boundaries to its state. So you could sail from Eastport and not have to put in to clear customs until you got to New Jersey. So if you were going to become independent in Maine, you would have to start clearing customs right after New Hampshire. So this is a very strong argument, and one of the reasons that coastal communities and anyone tied to shipping is strongly opposed to statehood. And William King, this sort of brilliant political strategist of statehood, who of course becomes the first governor of the state, he works to have the law changed, the federal law changed by the U.S. Congress. So that's changed in 1818. And then, of course, we have a landslide vote for independence in July of 1819.
Earl, you mentioned that in 1780, there were 97,000 people living in Maine. Do I remember?
1790.
Yes. 97,000. How well-to-do were most Mainers? Were only a few shipping captains well-to-do and the rest of people in Maine, you know, pretty much living a hardscrabble life?
Yeah, I think to a large degree the population was on a modest income level. We had a large number of farmers. We also had a large number of people who lived by the sea, fishermen. And in fact, when they come in 1820 to decide what the design of the state seal will be, the two figures on the state seal are the farmer and the mariner. And those were, I think, among the primary occupations. But you do at this period begin to have just the earliest stirrings of the Industrial Revolution that is going to play a major role in developing Maine before and after the Civil War. And you do begin to have factories in the early 1800s on a very small scale, manufacturing paper, textiles, other products. So it's a period of real fluidity in the way our economic structure is changing in Maine, and this will affect people into the 19th century.
One of the reasons I ask that question is I'm trying to picture myself back in Maine, a hardscrabble farmer living almost on the frontier, and I'm wondering how much I really care about whether Maine is a state. And I'm wondering, given that, how does one raise the enthusiasm and the momentum for support for such a thing? You know, we're having this conversation on the radio in a time of social media, but that was not the case in rural Maine. I'm guessing most people in Maine probably didn't even receive a newspaper back then. So, Liam, if you could kind of walk me through how the leaders of this movement got the people of Maine over that the period from 1780 to 1820 interested and engaged in the idea of statehood.
So you're right that, you know, it's a very rural state. We really don't have roads connecting many communities. As Earl said before, things are really by the sea and up rivers. But this is also an era of an explosion of print culture. Mm. And we really have got, we just have a handful of newspapers during the Revolution. But in the early Republic, those numbers grow and grow and grow.
Uh-huh.
And newspapers in this era are absolutely partisan vehicles, right? Today, we somewhat have an ideal of an unbiased press, but that was not the case in this period. So you've really got Federalist papers and Republican papers. Those printers are also printing pamphlets to make these arguments. You're having community meetings. I mean, we have just finished a revolution that was very much about mobilizing a population. So there are ways that even though it seems isolated and remote to how we think about the way we communicate today, that there was really a reach into a popular level about these political issues.
Was it a hard sell or an easy sell? Were most people on board with the idea early on?
No, it took several votes and many years for statehood. Liam can really fill in the details on that, but it was basically from about 1785 to 1820.
So it clearly was a hard argument, and I think this is something that really puzzles us today, right? Most people who live in Maine are familiar with having some suspicion, perhaps even hostility, about people from Massachusetts. So when we think back, well, why wouldn't they instantly say, we don't want to be part of that state, we're not even connected to them? Well, the fact is it took six votes from 1792 to 1819 to accomplish this. So clearly it was a difficult argument. And I think it's useful to think about this separation movement as similar to Brexit today, right? We are not sure what will happen. What will the consequences be? It could cause real problems. And so I think that's a useful analogy to help us realize why it took Maine so long to get to the point of what we might today think was an easy or obvious decision.
So walk us through what had to happen in the different levels of government, the different levels of legislation to make it happen. We had state, regional, and federal votes, correct?
So all voting was at the local level, but I would say that it's really an issue driven by states. In this era, the national government is very limited, does not really penetrate into the daily life of most people, but that's not the case with state government. And so there are a lot of issues, particularly taxation and land ownership rights, that are very controversial, even for ordinary farmers in a distant settlement on the frontier of Maine. And a lot of the large-scale property owners from this period own their land or have a legal claim to land based on dubious Indian deeds or they've inherited them from people who were loyalists during the revolution. So there's a lot of controversy and in play about those sorts of issues.
I'm guessing more the sort of the I'm asking more the logistics, like who had to vote in what kind of referendum in the state of Maine? And did the state of Massachusetts have to vote? And we, of course, are getting to the point where Congress votes on the Missouri Compromise. So before this gets to Congress, what has to pass?
So it's really determined by the Massachusetts legislature. They permit a popular vote to see if the District of Maine wants to separate. And they permit this six different times. And then, of course, the people with voting rights are adult men with some level of property. So they live, as Earl has suggested, very much on the coast of southwestern Maine and up rivers. You move beyond the Kennebec, beyond the Penobscot, we're talking about very limited English-speaking settlement that's just on the coast. But those are the places where these popular votes happen. And the movement to become independent doesn't grow steadily over time. They're actually dramatic ups and downs. In a lot of ways, I think the 1807 vote is the most interesting because it's really the low point of the Maine independence movement. This is the third of the six votes, and in 1807, only 26% of the population favored becoming independent from Massachusetts.
Why do you think that is?
So I do think it kind of comes back to the change in the partisan politics of statehood, that it began as a Federalist issue, but we've got this tidal wave of migration overwhelmingly coming from southern New England into mid-coast and down east Maine. And
so people from Massachusetts didn't want to vote to break away from Massachusetts, no?
It's not that. The majority of these people who are coming are poor, hardscrabble farmers. That is the constituency of the Republican Party. And so as that group becomes a majority, Maine voters are overwhelmingly Republican, whereas Massachusetts voters are one of the staunchest Federalist states in the U.S. So 1807 is really a turning point, as it had been a Federalist issue. Now Maine independence is becoming a Republican issue. And it so happens in 1807, a person born in Maine who began his career in Maine, James Sullivan, was elected governor of the state of Massachusetts as a Republican. So that 1807 year was funny. No one quite knew why they would make a strong argument for independence. And Republicans didn't, because they had this gubernatorial candidate who was only one of only two Republicans to win the governorship of Massachusetts in this period.
And coincidentally, in 1795, he had written the first history of Maine, called The History of the District of Maine by James Sullivan.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So let's see. It's time to take a break. We still haven't gotten to the Missouri Compromise, so we will talk about that when we get back. We'll also take your calls and questions. We're talking today about Maine becoming a state 200 years ago. The phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the University of Maine at Augusta, committed to providing a quality, affordable education online and in the classroom, uma.edu. Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial, deadriver.com. And Modern Pest Services, now featuring the Anti-CMEX Smart Pest Control System for your home. Learn more at modernpest.com.
President Trump says Iran appears to be standing down after a missile attack targeting U.S. forces in Iraq.
Which is a good thing for all parties concerned and a very good thing for the world.
Iranians have been strengthened. He's united Iranian society in a way which I think he hasn't comprehended.
I'm Ari Shapiro, a view from Iran this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the big story we're not talking about, the dangerously unstable relationship between the U.S. and China. We'll talk with New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos, whose new article is called The Future of America's Contest with China. Join us.
And that's coming up this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we're talking about Maine's path to statehood, part of our coverage of Maine's bicentennial. My guest in the studio with me, Liam Reardon with the University of Maine. He's a professor of history, and Earl Shuttleworth, who is longtime Maine state historian. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I also want to mention that there is a lot more information about Maine's bicentennial on the Maine Public website, which is bicentennial.mainepublic.org. And also, you can go to the Maine Bicentennial Commission's website at maine200.org. All sorts of links at both of those locations, and a lot of events coming up this year in the state of Maine as the state celebrates its bicentennial. Earl Shuttleworth, I think most people in school learned about Maine becoming a state as part of the Missouri Compromise, that Maine were to come into the Union as a free state and Missouri as a slave state. It was really complicated, though, wasn't it? And part of what was complicated about it is that for Maine to become a state, Maine's representatives in Congress, who are abolitionists, had to vote for a state to come into the Union as a slave state.
Yes, yes. And I think that we're very focused here in Maine today on celebrating our bicentennial, but we are really need to focus on the fact that that was exactly what was happening 200 years ago, that that issue that we had to satisfy in Congress to be able to get the votes to become a state, we had to do that compromise. And of course, this was a period in the Congress of great compromise. You had these three major political figures in the Congress at that time: Daniel Webster from Massachusetts, Henry Clay from Kentucky, and then John C. Calhoun from South Carolina. And they were the ones who, time and time again, in the period leading up to the Civil War — they all died in the early 1850s, but leading up to the Civil War — they found compromise after compromise in the relationship of free states to slave states as the Union developed, to be able to keep that balance and keep the nation from tearing itself apart. And we were early in that game.
Early in the game. Liam, you talked about William King earlier, who would go on to become Maine's first governor, although only for less than a year. His brother Rufus King voted differently than he did.
That's right. So the Maine-Missouri crisis is an extraordinary moment in American political history, and it's really the first time since the Constitutional Convention that the issue of slavery is really being raised on a national level. And it has brought the U.S. Congress to a standstill in 1819 when Missouri applied to be a new state. So in the midst of that controversy, Maine applies to be a state. And the sort of sausage is made in Washington, D.C. to connect these two, to keep this balance, as Earl has pointed out. But what's fascinating to me is that there were seven U.S. congressmen from the District of Maine — they still are operating as part of Massachusetts — and of those seven, five voted against the compromise. They decided that anti-slavery was more important than statehood. And that vote passes the U.S. House of Representatives by a vote of 90-87. So if the two minority members in Maine had voted differently, Missouri's admission as a slave state would have been blocked.
And were those people, were those congressmen who voted no, were they in favor of statehood?
Yes, they were. You know, it is a very complicated question and extremely interesting. And I just want to go back to William King for a second.
Sure.
Because it's fascinating. He's raised in Scarborough with a stepbrother, Rufus King, who is a very powerful U.S. senator and also a leading Federalist. He's also a champion of abolition. And King, who never holds federal office, because really the game is all in state-level politics, he gets reports back from his allies in the Congress in D.C. saying, oh, things are crazy. We've got to be really careful about this issue. We can't speak against the South. No one should talk about slavery. And at first, William King says, well, no, we want to be anti-slavery. But very quickly, he's persuaded by these two who favor statehood with the compromise. And so William King doesn't follow his brother's lead, which we would today see as the more ethical and moral position.
Mm. When Maine becomes a state, when the Missouri in 1820, was it a smooth transition? Did it all go okay?
Well, I think reasonably well, because we had anticipated this was going to happen, and there was a constitutional convention held here in Portland. In fact, it was held on the site of the present First Parish Church in the Old Jerusalem Meeting House in 1819, and so a constitution was developed. It was adopted. We were anticipating that statehood would finally occur, and very quickly the government got established. William King was sworn in as governor that spring of 1820. I believe he gave his inaugural address very early in June of 1820 here in Portland. We were off and running.
So, it had been 6 votes over 5 decades. Finally, there's a popular majority. There is the state constitutional convention that gets incredible participation. Almost every single town was represented there. It's approved by the voters, something like 92%. But then things go to D.C., and there's this terrible crisis over the relationship with Missouri. That's really bruising. Maine statehood squeaks by the narrowest of margins. And then I think there is one significant issue that threatens to trip up Maine statehood even at that late date. And it had to do with, would the new Maine government honor the obligations that the state of Massachusetts had made to Wabanaki nations in their treaties of the 1780s and 1790s. And this really was a big issue. There was a fair bit of money involved. And at this point, Massachusetts politicians would like to get rid of Maine.
Hmm.
Right? All those Republican voters are causing a problem for
Because they're federalists.
Control of Massachusetts. So all the political actors want this to go through. And the way to ensure that it did was that Massachusetts gave the state of Maine financial resources to honor those treaty obligations.
I'm going to go to Adita, who's calling from Durham. Hi, Adita. Go ahead.
Hi. First, I want to say thank you for doing the show. I'm really glad that you're doing the bicentennial so well on the station. Then the next thing I wanted to say, I wanted to make a comment that it was white men that were voting, not people of color, and white men of means that were voting, not your ordinary sort of folks here in Maine. And I wanted to know, you said that when this whole process started, you said the number of white settlers there were here in Maine. How many Native Americans, how many Abenaki were there here? And what was their relationship with the folks that wanted statehood? And is there any information about what the Wabanaki thought about that?
Adita, this is a great question. Thank you so much for calling. And our two historians are looking at each other like, this is a good one. Go ahead.
So it is a really important question. And that 1820 date of Maine becoming a state is really a problematic one for Wabanaki people in the state of Maine. I mean, it represents a continuation and in many respects an acceleration of colonial dispossession of Native American land and their sovereignty. And the Penobscot and the Passamaquoddy in particular had entered into treaty relationships with this colony and then the state of Massachusetts for centuries at this point. They had practiced and developed these relationships, and the idea that white settlers in the District of Maine would be less restrained by a distant government in Boston was really a threat. And I think they were right to be concerned about this. We look at the map of the protected homelands, and they shrink dramatically in the decades after 1820. So this is sort of the dark side of this dramatic expansion of the English-speaking population of Maine in the early 19th century. It is really a challenge to Wabanaki communities.
Mm-hmm. And just to add to that a little bit, just thinking about the geography of Maine, and in fact, one of the very important sort of visual processes that goes on is that for the first time there are a whole series of major maps of Maine made in the late 18th and early 19th century and published. Most notable are a series of maps by a man named Moses Greenleaf. These kind of visualize to people the vastness of Maine. And what we have really in this period is the fact that there is very little settlement above Bangor. And there's this whole area. In fact, the early accounts of Maine in this period, in the late 18th, early 19th century, talk about the upper half of the state being largely unsettled and unexplored. And, of course, they're not taking into consideration the St. John Valley, where the Acadian population has come in the 1780s.
And I want to, Adita, thank you so much for your question. And I want to follow up on that idea, too. You're talking about the Acadian population, Earl. We haven't talked about that yet. What did Maine statehood mean for the crown, what we now call the crown of Maine, far northern Maine?
Well, when Maine became a state in 1820, the whole issue of the northern border was still not resolved. It had not been resolved when the Revolution ended in the 1780s, and the whole issue continued on for several decades. It wasn't finally settled until 1842, 22 years after Maine became a state, by what's called the Webster-Ashburton Treaty, and that was Daniel Webster, who was Secretary of State at the time, and Lord Ashburton, who was representing Great Britain. And that finally drew the line to a large degree with the St. John River as the boundary between American Maine and English Canada.
So that probably wasn't that probably would have happened whether that part of the world was part of Maine or Massachusetts, because that was a congressional line.
Yes, although there was, I think that it was hastened by a lot of activity here in Maine, because by the 1830s, there was a great lumber boom in Bangor.
Mm.
And there was, for the first time, people were looking northward to exploit the resources of the vast forests. And the whole question was, where did the line happen? What was Maine forest versus what was Canadian forest? And that ultimately participated in a little war called the Aroostook War.
Liam?
So I do think statehood was a real challenge to French speakers in the St. John Valley. And even today, many residents of that region feel very far away from most of the rest of the state. And this really represented, you know, they did not participate in these elections, right? They were, all these votes are coming from coastal English-speaking communities. And they really don't know, you know, their major ties are upriver to Quebec and downriver to St. John. There's a great footnote in the census of 1820. Penobscot County is a brand new county, and the third biggest community in Penobscot County is Madawaska. But then there's an asterisk, and you read at the bottom of the census report, and the person writing it says, these French speakers think they are part of Canada.
Right.
And in fact, you can only get there by going upriver from St. John. But when the county line is eventually drawn, I am quite sure this will be part of Penobscot County.
Oh, interesting. Wow. We're talking about Maine state history, especially the Maine becoming a state. Before we go to a break, I want to ask you, Earl, and I know I'm jumping around a little bit, but we've been talking about, we were talking a few minutes ago about the Constitutional Convention. Was there anything about Maine's Constitution that set us apart from other states from the beginning?
Well, I think to a large degree, we were basing our Constitution on the national Constitution. Liam?
So this is a good one for me.
No,
so,
no, that's okay. A good one for you. Right.
So we really base the state constitution on the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780, right? Mm. That is sort of the blueprint. But there are a couple of very significant changes that are very telling. So perhaps the most important issue that we haven't talked about at all is religion and statehood. And it is something of a surprise to most people that Massachusetts, which included the District of Maine, had a state-supported church into the 1830s. So regardless of your personal faith, you paid taxes to support the congregational minister in your town. Now, this was an outrage to Baptists and Methodists in particular, and these large number of new incoming migrants. Not only are they overwhelmingly Republican, they're also overwhelmingly Methodist and Baptist. So this is one of the major changes in the Maine state constitution. And the discussion of the issue is fascinating. One of the delegates to the Maine state constitution explicitly says that you could be a Hindu or a Muslim and still have voting rights in the new state of Maine.
I understand Hindu is spelled H-I-N-D-O-O.
And it's really Mohammedan.
That's right. Mohammedan or Hindu. That's right.
And let me just do one more really important distinctive thing about the Constitution. It has no property requirement to vote, so that is better than the Massachusetts Constitution, and it's not debated. It's everyone agrees there should not be a property requirement, and we will allow free people of African descent, free men of African descent, will have the right to vote in the new state of Maine, and that is going against the trend of state constitutions in this era that are taking away black voting rights that existed in revolutionary era constitutions and are being taken out in the 18 teens and 20s.
So in three ways, Maine's constitution was quite progressive for its time in that you didn't have to own land to vote. You could, there was no state religion, and people of color could vote.
Men,
excuse me. Important distinction. We are going to take another quick break. We'll be right back talking about Maine's becoming a state.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the University of Maine at Augusta, committed to providing a quality, affordable education online and in the classroom. UMA.edu. Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm, and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial, deadriver.com. And Modern Pest Services, offering a non-toxic approach to pest control with anti-CMEX smart pest control technology, modernpest.com.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On January 9, 1862, the first petroleum shipment from the United States to Europe arrives at Victoria Docks, London, England, aboard the ship the Elizabeth Watts. Launched in 1847 by the shipbuilding firm of J. and C. C. Morton of Thomaston, Maine, the Elizabeth Watts was about 96 feet long with a draft of 11 feet. 1,329 40-gallon whiskey barrels containing crude oil were loaded onto the Elizabeth Watts for the journey across the Atlantic.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of DN Wealth Advisors and the Maine Seacoast Mission. Happy birthday, Maine.
Throughout 2020, Maine Public is joining others around the state in celebrating the first 200 years of Maine's statehood. We're sharing historical information, interesting facts, and personal recollections. We're looking back at how this great state of Maine developed and also peering ahead for the next 200 years. Whether you listen or watch on Maine Public Radio services or television, You can find it again or for the first time at mainepublic.org. Look for the Maine State Bicentennial Hub link under the radio, television, or education dropdowns, where you will also find links to our bicentennial partners, including the Maine State Archives, the Maine State Historical Society, and the Maine State Bicentennial Commission. Happy birthday, Maine!
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Understanding Maine Statehood and What Was Happening Here 200 Years Ago. Joining me, Earl Shuttleworth, historian whose focus is the state of Maine, and Liam Reardon, a UMaine professor who focuses on early American history. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. I'm looking at the clock and almost panicking because we're not going to get to all these questions. Are both of you giving presentations this year that people can attend and learn more?
Oh, very much so. In fact, March 15th, which is Statehood Day, there's a major celebration in the afternoon at the Armory in Augusta. I'm sure the public is welcome. I'm going to be speaking at that, and I know Liam has quite a few presentations lined up as well.
Yep. There's a lot of interest, and it's fun to get out and talk to people about the statehood era.
Okay. So if you don't get your question in today, fear not. You'll have a chance at some point this year. Earlier, we were talking about how word spread of the yes. in the movement, in the statehood movement. And Earl, I know that you say that newspapers then were not what we conceive of them today necessarily.
Right. Well, for one thing, what we have to remember is that newspapers were usually four pages, and they were printed on very basic presses. The first newspaper published in Maine was here in Portland in 1785, the Cumberland Gazette. And then the next newspaper was up in Hollowell in the 1790s. And then ultimately there were newspapers published in Bangor and in Augusta as well. But there were only a few newspapers initially in the late 18th, early 19th century. But then in part, I think, because of this controversy over statehood in the early 19th century, newspapers expanded. And as Liam has mentioned earlier on, newspapers became very partisan, and oftentimes it was a particular party or even an individual who would own a newspaper to promote a particular political point of view. And so one of the great things about these newspapers between 1785 and 1820 is that they're one of our most valuable, rich, and deepest resources about the whole whole discussion, the whole debate about statehood.
This is why we know so much.
That's why we know so much.
That's great.
Yes.
Go ahead.
In fact, I think the Falmouth Gazette was really founded as a vehicle to argue for Maine independence. The
yes.
very first issue has an article saying that Maine should be independent.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I've learned in my research that most surprised me was digging into what happened with the Maine U.S. congressman who voted in D.C. about that controversial Maine-Missouri forced union. And it was such a challenging and controversial election that both sides published in newspapers to explain why they took the stand that they did. And the people who opposed statehood and opposed slavery, so they opposed slavery and therefore they opposed Maine statehood connected to Missouri, had this to say about why they took their stand. "We are afraid of the slave power as corrupting Republican government, which is abhorrent to our notions of the rights of man and humanity, and it is a falsehood to call this a compromise, which we utterly protest against and refuse to sanction with our approbation." So I have taken to no longer calling it the Maine-Missouri Compromise. I call it the Maine-Missouri Crisis, since these people involved in it said this was not a compromise. This was forced upon us.
Email from Jean. Where did the name Maine originate?
Oh, there are a number of theories on that. One is, I believe there's a province in France. Another is just the idea that, the Maine, the ocean. Other thoughts on that, Liam?
I think the one that connects it to France
is probably the most likely.
Yeah. And I think it really does speak to the confusion, the complexity about the claim to own land in this region.
We'll go to Nancy, who's calling for Broke Bluffs. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Okay. Thank you. Very interesting. I'm interested in when Maine adopt, if they did adopt the state immunity, and if so, do we still have it, as well as do other states have it, and why?
Nancy, what do you mean by state immunity?
State immunity comes from England, I think in 1600, that the king could do no wrong. And here in Maine, the people who have immunity, who run the state, have, and the university, have state immunity. They're not responsible if they cause a problem, a death, or anything. And so I'm very curious about this because they get away with a lot.
Both of our historians
so
are shaking their heads.
With this as a legal
I think that's
tradition
a good legal. It's a good question for someone with who knows legal history.
All right, Nancy.
It might actually be a good question for the state law library. Reference at the state law library.
Thank you, Nancy. Martin on Facebook asks, "What do you think would have happened if Maine had not become a state?"
That's interesting.
Do you think it would have eventually become a state?
I think that it was inevitable that it was going to become a state. I think so many of the factors we've already discussed, the fact that geographically it was separated from Massachusetts by New Hampshire, the fact that it was having this great surge in development after the Revolution. I mean, you go from, you know, from a population of roughly 100,000 to a population of 300,000 in, you know, in 30 years. It's almost like a kind of manifest destiny, really. And also all of the economic and social developmental issues that go along with that population development. I think it would have just been a matter, if it hadn't been 1820, it would have been just a matter of time before it had happened.
And you agree?
I do. If you look at that final vote in July of 1819, 72% of voters statewide favor independence. I mean, you can't get that big a agreement in U.S. politics or elections today, so it was a solid majority.
An email here. Originally in 1820, Maine required a majority to elect the governor, senators, and representatives, but that was changed by legislature and referendum to the most votes win system now in use. That change began in 1847 for the elections to the House. What was the reason for switching to the most votes method? Was it because in the early 1800s it was nearly impossible to administer the additional runoff election?
So that is a good technical question. I do think a runoff was not practical. So, and I think the law was changed in response to very close contested elections. That was often the case then, as it is now, a very divided popular vote.
All right, we'll go to Jonathan calling from Harpswell. Hi, Jonathan. Go ahead.
Hello. Oh, thank you very much. So happy birthday to Maine. But I just was, so I grew up in Harpswell, and I grew up across from this island called Malaga Island, where I was told as a kid that there used to be heavy segregation of black residents, and they weren't allowed to live on the mainland. In Phippsburg. So I was curious as to a state that came to be as a free state, how is it justified at the time to continue to carry out such heavy segregation laws and not be able to really be able to represent equal rights at that time, even though I understand that we still have
sure.
those issues today.
Yeah. Thanks for your question, Jonathan. Go ahead.
Well, With Malaga Island specifically, my understanding is that it was settled in the late 18th century primarily as a very small fishing community, and that it had a people of mixed race who lived there through the 19th and early 20th century. And then in the early 20th century, the area nearby, the contingency mainland, began to be developed for summer tourism, summer cottages, and so on. And it was at that point that those people, in a discriminatory fashion really asserted the state government to come in and actually remove those people. And they were taken to what is now Pineland. It was a dark chapter in Maine history, and one in which both Governor Baldacci and Governor LePage formally apologized for.
A dark chapter, and a lot of attention to it in recent years. A documentary film exhibits it. The museum, the Maine State Museum.
There's a great young adult novel,
right.
Lizzie Bright. And,
but so to Jonathan's point, was Malaga an exception, or was segregation imposed throughout the state?
Oh no, I think generally it was an exception. I think there certainly in the pre-Civil War period, of course, for one thing, we did not have a large black population to begin with. It was primarily along the coast, and in particular, the largest population would have been Portland, where many people of Afro-American background would have worked on the docks and in the east end of the city and so on. There was a community there that, of course, created the Abyssinian Church.
Yeah, so that's absolutely true. The Abyssinian Church is a great institution to mention in the context of statehood, because right in this era, this was a church for free black Christians in the state of Maine. You know, I do think on this broad question of racism and discrimination, it's an important point to make that people could take an anti-slavery stand for a whole range of reasons. And as we heard in that newspaper statement I read before, a lot of anti-slavery commitment was because of fear of slave power, that is, the political power of states with slavery. So you could be a racist and favor a strategy of sending people of African descent back to Africa, mm-hmm. and be anti-slavery at the same time. So I do think discrimination, it was powerful and widely shared among the white population in Maine well into the 20th century.
Jonathan, thank you for your excellent question. And it's going to be our last question. Believe it or not, we're out of time. And I really appreciate Earl Shuttleworth, you and Liam Reardon being here to share some of your knowledge. So much to learn about Maine's history, so much we didn't know already. Liam Reardon, professor of history at the University of Maine, who specializes in the Revolutionary era, and Earl Shuttleworth, longtime Maine State historian. Again, for more information about Maine's bicentennial, you can go to Maine Public's website, bicentennial.mainepublic.org. There is also a Maine Bicentennial Commission site that includes events happening around the state, including, I'm sure, the talks given by Earl and Liam, and that's maine200.org. We will be doing Maine Calling programs throughout the year about topics around the bicentennial, so we hope you'll stay tuned. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.